Welcome to Slate's I Have to Ask. I'm Isaac Chotiner. My guest today is David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker magazine. Remnick began editing The New Yorker in 1998. Before then, he was a staff writer for the magazine, and before that, a Moscow correspondent for The Washington Post. His coverage of the fall of communism later became the book Lenin's Tomb, which won the Pulitzer Prize. In addition to editing the magazine, Remnick, who is now 59, continues to write frequently on Russia, Israel, music, Donald Trump, and other subjects. He also hosts the New Yorker Radio Hour, a weekly podcast which you can download and subscribe to after you subscribe to this one. What you're about to hear is part one of our conversation. Part two will be up next week. In that conversation, we discuss the future of the New Yorker, possible changes to the magazine, ideological diversity, and a bunch of other things. This one is a little bit more political focused. So here it is. David, thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you. Good to see you.
It's good to see you. I wanted to start. You just did a big feature about Hillary Clinton. Yeah. And in the piece, you mention an experience 20 plus years ago where you met Hillary Clinton at a dinner or some event. And I was curious, spending time with her now after going through this horrific thing, what you made of her and the way she's changed as someone who's been observing her for two plus decades.
Well, unlike a lot of journalists who've spent tons of time with the Clintons over the years, I have not. I have not. I wrote a long profile of Bill Clinton in his post-presidency and went around Africa, and it was the lead up to her announcement that she was going to run in 2008. But whatever contact I've had, to be clear, has been intermittent. But I do really distinctly remember this. This was in 1993. I had just come back, maybe a year back, from Moscow, where I'd been posted for the Washington Post. And the Clintons were in that early stage of combativeness with the press. And obviously there was a lot more to come.
And to come, I should say.
Absolutely. Many, many years of it to come. And the late Michael Kelly, who went on to be the editor of The New Republic and The Atlantic and a writer for The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine, and then died in Iraq at the very beginning of the Iraq War, the Second Iraq War, wrote a scathing profile of her. You remember this cover? It's before your time to remember, maybe, but it was her in white, against a white background. The cover line in the New York Times Magazine was Saint Hillary. And she came out of it looking like the most sanctimonious and power-hungry person on earth. She came out looking terrible, and she knew it. And Michael clearly had no great affection for Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton, or Al Gore, as it turned out, when he came to
almost pathological, I mean, yeah.
Well, your word.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
And so they had a dinner at the White House, not a state dinner, not an affair of state in any way. But there seemed to me, my wife and I went, very young at the time, and I got plunked next to Hillary Clinton. And for the better part of the dinner, she talked about this piece. She was really obsessed with it, didn't know why it had happened. Was in that early stage of questioning the motives of the New York Times. There was no Breitbart. Drudge hadn't even appeared. There was no if there was a vast right-wing conspiracy, it was only taking shape out of sight in the form of what Sidney Blumenthal would then call a counter-establishment. But I really, that was the thing that was most memorable to me all those years later, was her animosity to the, not just Michael Kelly in that piece, but her feeling that this force was pitted against her and him.
And what about now? What did you make of her spending time with, or, you know, interviewing her, and what did you make of the book?
Well, her previous books were almost willfully, assertively uninteresting. They were products. They were either to create an image or to reach out to a constituency or something like that, or in the case of the Living History, to have a she did what politicians have been doing since the year Z, since Andrew Jackson, and in the myth of the myths of the log cabin and so on. Politicians try to create a mythos for themselves infused with truth and true stories. They were boring books, you know, written by committee. This book is pretty raw, and not just by Hillary Clinton standards. It is, there's no office left to run for, and she certainly is not the first person to lose an election to write a book. A lot of people have lost elections and written a book. And it's angry, and it's self-lacerating, and it's questioning. And I thought there was a lot of humanity in it. And a lot of people are so angry at what happened in the election, understandably. I think we share that. So at a loss when it comes to Donald Trump, that they just want to blame everything on her and tell her, shut up and go away and disappear from the political scene. I think that's...
What did you make of her critique of the press?
You know, when I was at the Washington Post, the legendary Ben Bradley was the editor, and he used to say, every time we got criticized in some way, he used to say, now don't get into a defensive crouch. So I won't. But I think the idea that the only thing that anybody ever covered about Hillary Clinton in this whole campaign was emails is just demonstrably wrong. But the larger points about email obsession, which was a colossal mistake, make no mistake of it. She made a colossal mistake with that private email server for reasons we can, you know, mull over.
Although in hindsight, colossal, it seems like minor, right?
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, that's the complication. Yeah.
Totally point well taken. I look, she's seeing it all through the prism of, understandably, the behavior of the other guy who's, you know, vacuousness and dishonesty and cynicism, his encouragement and an inflammation of the ugliest currents of American politics and psychology, I think are indisputable. Indisputable. To say nothing of Russian involvement in the election, and we don't know all the details of this, but even the frame of it is like some horrific movie. So she's writing in that atmosphere. So I have to say, people who are utterly dismissive of her and who just wanted to go away, there's something ugly about it.
I haven't heard you talk or write about this, so I'm curious, because there's been a debate about why she lost, and I would say, or why the country was willing to give 46% of the vote to Donald Trump, more so in swing states. And I think broadly speaking, that debate has come down to people looking for racial and cultural explanations and people looking for economic explanations. And I know some of your writers like George Packer have weighed in on this subject. Ta-Nehisi Coates has a big essay in The Atlantic this month about this. What have you kind of made of that debate, and where do you find yourself? How do you find yourself thinking about it?
Well, to me, what it is a list of empirical reasons. And the question is how you cut it up into the pie chart of which is the dominant reason. And there I have no great answer for you. Obviously, Ta-Nehisi Coates believes that race is the predominant reason. I think it would be a caricature of his position to say he thinks it's the only reason. And others, you know, are focused on other reasons. I don't know how to carve that pie chart up. I don't even know the dimension of some of the reasons. But I do know this. You have to start by admitting the following, that 40-odd percent of the population automatically votes Republican, no matter who it is, whether it's Donald Trump or Mitt Romney or Gorilla Monsoon. And 40-odd percent of the population votes for the Democrat, no matter who it is, Barack Obama, Michael Dukakis, or
Sean Penn.
Or
in
Sean
2020,
Penn.
Yeah.
So the whole drama is being played out, even in the most conventional election, in a fairly narrow slice of the populace. You could argue, you know, which is the most informed slice of the populace, and what are the tactics that are employed to go after that slice of the populace? I have no, I can't answer, Isaac, by saying it's 86% race and 14% misogyny and da-da-da Russia. I just don't know. I don't think you do, and I don't think Ta-Nehisi or George or anybody really knows.
Well, I guess one
– I do know.
Yeah.
I do know that it's very clear from empirical evidence and reporting and watching and listening and hearing that racism, misogyny, xenophobia, the harnessing of certain kinds of rage were exploited by the man who's the president of the United States.
Right. Well, just to go back, I mean, I think your point about 40% is right. And I think we may look back and say the
more.
True.
I mean,
more,
it's 46. And
right.
Some, you know.
Right. I think the really shocking thing in a way is that a candidate like him was able to get a major party nomination, because that's where he could have been stopped. And once you get to
but
the final two.
But he rolled through them.
No. But I'm saying historically.
16, 17 of them. You have to.
We
have to grapple with this reality that, yes, a lot of them were not political forces of the highest caliber, let's say. They were awful. But he beat them. And he beat them bing, bang, boom.
And that's what's the shocking thing, because once you get to the last two, you're going to get 40+% of the vote no matter what. But I think one way to think about this question, I agree.
And we haven't covered her baggage.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is the Clintons have been in the public eye for nearly four decades. And depending on your view of the Clintons, she was carrying so many large rocks in her knapsack uphill that – there were just a hell of a lot of people that just didn't trust her, didn't like her. Now, where misogyny fits into this, where all kinds of unfair and awful things fit into this is up to us to discuss. But she was by no means a lock.
Well, one way of thinking about it, I agree, we can't do a pie chart, is if Trump sort of doesn't deliver on making people's lives better, but does deliver on this sort of white nationalism and maintains the amount of support that I assume
he – But what does it mean to deliver on white nationalism?
Because
he's doing a pretty good job of signaling
– That's what I mean. He gets up every day and he makes white people feel like I'm looking out for your interests and not the interests of people who don't look like you.
Well, I would argue that not all white people, not even close to all white people, respond to these ugly signalings, and I hope it contributes to defeating him.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about the race thing, just which is you've written a lot about race in America going back many years. You've written a lot about John Lewis and Barack Obama, and I'm just wondering, when you look at kind of the – I mean, I know there's a phrase about the arc of history bending towards, you know, but when you look at an issue you've been thinking about for a long time, did this fundamentally change the way you thought about it or thought about American history?
I think any sentient person, even the most optimistic, has to wrestle with the reality that ugliness and evil and prejudice is not going to disappear from the face of the earth. That what in history would tell us that it would disappear entirely? Is America so exceptional that it can overcome a legacy of its original sins, slavery, and then Jim Crow and Jim Crow Redux, absolutely and completely? I don't think so. So, and I'm an optimist. And if anything, the two books that I wrote about race, one about Ali, one about Obama, can be criticized more from the side of me being too optimistic than and writing into certain historical moments that had optimism written all over it, than being a pessimist. But I think you have to grapple with that all the time.
What have you made of the sort of new strain of writing at places like The New Yorker, places like The Atlantic? Jelani Cobb, who's a staff writer here, uh-huh. Ta-Nehisi Coates, writing about race in a different way than even when I was growing up, which was more recent than when you were growing up. That sounded aggressive.
It's okay. It's okay.
But no, that it does feel very different. That
I think what it is a function of having more African American writers at places like the New Yorker. When I first got here as a writer, there was Jervis Anderson, who was not writing very much. The late Jervis Anderson, who wrote a biography of Bayard Rustin, a very good book about Harlem. Hilton Knowles followed. Jamaica Kincaid had written for the New Yorker. There had been black writers, but as staff writers, as real presences, you know, now on the web as well as in print, it was de minimis. And I think you can look around at other publications and say the same. I'm not. This is not by way of patting myself or ourselves on the back, but there's just more. And among those African American voices, they disagree. Khalif Hassanna does not agree in all ways with Jelani Cobb or Vincent Cunningham or Alexis Acuayo or many other people who are Doreen St. Felix, a lot of people that write for us. But that's why you do this. That's why you go out and you seek out people who are not your lunch buddies at the college you went to.
To
come write.
What have you made of Ta-Nehisi Coates' writing, just as someone who you said about yourself a couple minutes ago, was sort of fundamentally an optimist? And I think one of the things that
Ta-Nehisi is fundamentally—
No, that you are. Or you said that you're writing—
This is, that's, the, look, that's where, he was on the first broadcast of the New Yorker Radio Hour. That was the conversation we had. It was in the wake of his second book. And I think Ta-Nehisi is a terrific, terrific writer. I mean, you know, if you ask me about competition with The Atlantic, of course I'm jealous of Ta-Nehisi Coates. Why any sane person would be. Doesn't mean I have to agree with him in every groove. I don't, you know, George Packer, who just, you know, had a debate with Ta-Nehisi, don't agree in everything. That's not trying to create a ideologically, if anything, we're probably at times too predictable. And more argument is better for a magazine as well as a culture.
Yeah, no, I guess the thing I was sort of thinking about was, it does feel like, I feel like when I was growing up, that when you read things by liberal writers or conservative writers about race in America, mm-hmm. it always had this tone of things are going to get better. There's this optimism about where we're going. And I think that's really changed about the dialogue. And maybe you say that's just about having
more— I think it has gotten better. And when you press Ta-Nehisi on the overall, I think he thinks things have gotten better. It's just a question of what kind of time period are you talking about? Ta-Nehisi is an extremely intelligent man, and he knows very well, you know, where things have gotten better, but he also knows how to read prison statistics, and he knows very well the facts where we are dreadful in this country still on matters of race.
You obviously have written a lot about Obama, spent a bit of time with him, I think, for your reporting.
So,
yeah. Did Trump's election and just what we've seen in America and American politics in the last 2 years—
It's a repudiation.
Well, no, but—
In some quarters. Again, we're talking about, remember what the margin of difference is in an election. So let's not talk about it as the nation was 100% pro-Obama and then went 100% pro-Trump. Let's stipulate that in the beginning. But some part of the pie chart that we're talking about has to do with some percentage of people who are rebelling against 8 years of a black president, and that Ta-Nehisi was writing about this.
Right. No, I guess I meant, does it make you sort of change the way you look at Obama and Obamaism, that this could follow him about sort of what he was able to do as a political figure or wasn't able to do?
How do you mean? What specifically?
Well, I think a lot of people like myself thought that after 2008, it would be very difficult, that the country was in a place and he represented a brand of politics that following it up with someone like Trump was unlikely to happen. And I think I was very naive in that view. But it also, it does make me think that there's sort of – that he represents a sort of technocratic style of government and politics to some degree. He also has something else to him. But that in some way is insufficient to the current moment. And I was
– ideologically.
Not so much ideologically, maybe just sort of tonally, and that you need a certain sort of populism, which is obviously a very broad word.
It's a hugely broad word,
yeah.
And it ranges from, you know, Huey Long and Donald Trump and some really ugly figures in American history to someone, you know, and I think it's a little racially coded too, by the way.
Yes.
To someone who might do better at a factory floor rally in Scranton. So is Joe Biden a populist, really? It doesn't seem to me he is. Does he have a slightly better rap when it comes to working class people? Maybe. I don't think that makes him a populist. Again, let's keep one thing in mind. Donald Trump won. Donald Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million votes, and he won the Electoral College election on the margins in the states that we know. I think we should – those of us who have the opportunity in the press or in civil society and do what we can to do our jobs, in the case of the press, is to put pressure on power, to put pressure on hatred, to expose what's wrong, all the things that we're supposed to do. But let's not think that the country itself has gone from one extreme of goodness and beauty and honey and milk and honey and light to now we are something polar opposite. This is political struggle. This is political struggle, political argument. We lost colossally.
Okay,
and it's ugly, and the results are yet to be known. It could be just catastrophic in some ways, but it is this happens in politics. This just happens to be the struggle of our time.
Okay, but stipulating that, I mean, has this changed the way you think about Obama or his style of politics at all, or not so much? I mean, granting that this is around the margins and Trump only got 46%, but just the moment we're in politics,
would I prefer that Obama be heroic in all ways and right on all questions? Sure. It would be great if all he did was, you know, do good works now. And but, you know, I don't see any president. They all, in some, with the exception for the most part of Jimmy Carter, they all cash in, and that's disappointing. It's disappointing.
Does it surprise you about Obama?
I don't think Obama was immune to the lures of the new class of wealth. I think he's very interested in Silicon Valley, stars in show business and sports and the rest. I don't think he's immune to those lures. I mean, he finishes the presidency, and the next thing you know, he's on a private island with Richard Branson. I'm not sure that's, you know, that doesn't make him John Lewis. This is what these guys do, and it's disappointing. It's impure.
Yeah, the Richard Branson thing, it was surprised me.
It's not just Richard.
Your first. Yeah, no, right.
And I, you know, I'll tell you this. It's overrated in the literary sense because of the role it played in politics, but he wrote a very good book as a young man. It was kind of a meld of, what would you call it, memoir and kind of fictionalized memoir and pushed into the shape of this becoming story. The second book was, you know, just an ordinary political book by what I thought was, and I still do think, a very decent liberal. He has the chance to write the first good presidential autobiography. People say that Ulysses S. Grant did with Mark Twain's help, but it's probably kind of overrated, and all the rest of them are mostly garbage. He could do a great service by writing a great book and not do it with speech writers and teams and all the rest. I'd love to see him write something that's that grapples not only with his place in history and racial progress and all the rest, but even the most difficult questions in the most detail, because whether it's healthcare or Syria, because we're still wrestling with it, questions of intervention, non-intervention, how we deal with the disadvantage in this country. He could make a great contribution by writing a serious book or series of books. I just hope it's not just a product.
The way you said Syria to me just now, I sense that maybe you think that that's a place where he needs to address his legacy and what did or didn't happen under his term. Is that how you feel, or am I overreading it? Or
No, I think he has to. I think even if in the end you agree with what he did and did not do, you have to also agree that when you have a situation in which hundreds of thousands of people are killed, a million refugees, the destabilization not only of the Middle East, but Europe, essentially, and Europe's politics,
I think it had some political effect here.
The empowerment of Russia and Russian power, that can't be considered a good outcome. So what's the rationale for non-intervention? It's clearly in the wake of Iraq. It's clearly we're reacting to our self-disgust, justified self-disgust with Iraq and in a more complicated way with Afghanistan. But a true grappling with that from the person who made the decision and series of decisions would be of value. It doesn't solve anything. It doesn't bring back the dead. It doesn't undo the decisions and non-decisions. But that would be of some importance.
And that's our show for today. I Have to Ask is produced by Audrey Dilling. Our theme music was composed by Doug Chase. If you have an idea for a guest or just want to let me know your thoughts, email me at ask@slate.com. That's ask@slate.com. If you're in the Bay Area, I've got a live show coming up at Books, Inc. in San Francisco on September 26th. I'll be interviewing author Franklin Foer about his new book, World Without Mind. To make sure you get a seat, head to booksinc.net. That's booksinc.net.